Good to see all of you tonight. And we have more tonight than we had last night. This is Friday night. Good to see you. I know it's been a long week for some of you because of your schedules, work and school, and whatever your day-to-day pursuits happen to be. I appreciate very much people who are dedicated and those who come every night and those who do the best they can and come most nights. I know it's a sacrifice for you. And appreciate and actually it's a humbling thing when the event is somebody like me being here, and you know I'm the visiting guy, and I know it's different ones come at different times and all of that, but the responsibility is upon me at this time to preach these lessons, and I appreciate very much you willing to come and hear me as I do what I can. This week has been a wonderful week to me, and I think some of you have expressed your appreciation for what I've done, but that means a tremendous amount to me, and the prayers that have been led mean so much. I can't, you know, really express what the appreciation of the good prayers that have been led in my behalf, but you know, other things to say about that. I don't want to take up too much time, but you know. And whenever I have an opportunity to visit in a place that I've never been before, and this is like that, in that I'd heard about the church here and was curious, you know, because I always love to know that there are faithful churches wherever, you know, you hear of them. You say, well, how large is the church? How many people do they have? Is it a growing church? You know, who preaches there, of course, as well, usually. But so much the stand of the local church for the truth is just here is just incredibly encouraging to me. And I think as much as anything, I think if you were to ask me what was my first impression of it, other than the fact that the church stands for the truth, is a sound congregation, is the fact that you have a fantastic group of young people. And the future is obviously in their hands, and it's in good hands. I'm not too worried about the young people here from what I've seen. I know it's a short visit and it's not all, you know, you can't know much, but my impression is through this week that you should rely upon your young people, that they are a wonderful asset that this church is blessed to have. We don't have that where I am currently. We kind of had our generation of young people all move away, and we're hoping to raise a new crop, you know, but that takes time. So, but it's just wonderful to see that you have the group that you do, and that they are capable. They wait on the Sunday service with the Lord's Supper was something that I will tell people about. The song leading by the young people is wonderful, and the prayers that are led, all of those things. Obviously, there's knowledge behind the what I see in these actions and their part. And of course, the families that have had me out to eat, like I need to be fed, you know, have fed me too well and have gone to trouble to do that, and I have enjoyed it immensely. And getting to know them a little bit, sitting at the table with people and talking about common things and getting to know each other, there's not really a better setting, I think, for that than sharing a meal together. And their hospitality has been fantastic. And you'll be in my prayers for a long time. I promise you, you'll be in my prayers. I've been in yours this week, but you'll be in mine for a long time, because it's been a shot in the arm to me to see you and to meet you and to know that, to me, way up here in the Northwest is a sound, faithful church that has surprised me. I, of course, the thing is, I knew Joe and Dan, of course, as they've mentioned, we've worked together for the last couple of years in India. Joe might as well have been with Dan and I last year. We prayed about him every day, and the brethren talked about him, and they were asking, how in the world did he fall and break his shoulder anyhow, you know? And how did that happen? But we talked about it all the time when Dan and I were there last time. But the first visit that I had in India was when I really was able to spend some time with and meet both of these men. I shared a room, well, we had a double room thing there in Bangalore, in the same place that we usually stay. And you get to know somebody pretty well. Dan had a separate room right above us, and we ate all of our meals together. We traveled together every day, and we did the teaching and the work that we do over there together. And you get to know men very well during that time. And So it was a unique experience both times. This last time without Joe, Dan and I had to wing it, and without Joe and you know, and it's different with it. It's just two of us, isn't it? And so, but this time Dan's not going, and Joe and I are going, so kind of the opposite situation. And this is the second time this year that I'll have gone, because we're going back a little quicker this trip, because we're changing the time of the year that we're going. We're hoping to go next year at this same time and do it every year in the fall, and Dan, Lord willing, will join us next time, and the three of us will be back again. And we do work together well as a team. It's harder, just two of us. I know that it will be, and we appreciate Dan very much, and look forward to him joining us next time, good Lord willing. I want to talk tonight about a subject that I you know, kind of teased the thing last night a little bit, maybe too much, I hope not, but turn over, if you will, and I want us to start out, actually the blessings in John 21, but the comments I want to do start in Luke 22, and I want us to go over there. We're going to sort of introduce the concept there. I mentioned that we would be studying the lesson and the application from that lesson that comes from chapter 21. There's no charts tonight. I hope I don't scare anybody by not using the PowerPoint. Preachers need to be able to preach without PowerPoint. I know that sounds silly, maybe a little obvious, but you know, we do it a lot. We have to, especially. I mean, we use PowerPoint in India, though. You know, so it's not as if they don't have PowerPoint. But it's something that members of the church in our studies. What we want to do in a study like this is just concentrate on the scriptures. And I'd like to introduce the lesson as we. The lesson will be coming from John 21, but let's turn to Luke 22 as our intro here, and we'll begin about verse 24. So a passage of scripture that a lot of you know, and especially some have already mentioned to me that they know what my application is going to be from chapter 21, and I hope you do. Actually, one time when, I guess the first time that we were in India, I tried to do this lesson, and it doesn't work to be translated in Telugu. It doesn't, because the whole thing is translation from English into Greek and understanding the Greek meaning in order to make the application, and that's too convoluted to do it in a language like that. So it really, for me, has only worked to do it from English and to look at the Greek definitions as we're trying to make application. So they've heard a little bit of what I have to say about this, but it was a little bit strange. And so, but the reason that I want to preach this sermon, I want us to concentrate on this lesson tonight, is the impact I think that it can have on people when they understand the lesson thoroughly. And it's very strong for young people. And I say that because it hit me when I was about 24, the meaning of this passage. And I had been, of course, was raised, I mentioned last night, raised a preacher's kid, and never wanted to be a preacher, never cared about it. I did, you know, that was just not the thing I needed to do, but I felt like when I was going to college and a member of the church in Houston for a number of years, I began teaching high school classes and the college age. I was barely above the college age myself when I started doing that, leading singing and those kind of things. Got me more involved in the worship of the local church, but I really never wanted to be a preacher. And then the lesson, the meaning of this lesson, kind of hit me. And I had had many experiences in life at that point that were really, even though I had been raised as a preacher's kid, really, my own experiences were not leading me toward more godliness. Let's put it that way, but actually away from godliness. And actually being worldly. And so when the lesson here, I understood what the Lord meant in this great lesson. It's something that has stayed with me through the years. And I've tried to tell it. It's not new to me. I know the passage, you know, because I've told people about it privately and I've preached it. And I haven't written it, I don't think, anywhere, but I have, you know, preached it and taught it. And let's just go through this text, and we'll bring this out. You may be very familiar with this, but in chapter 22 of Luke and verse 24, it says, "And there was also a strife among them, which of them should be accounted the greatest." This is among the Jesus' disciples. "And he said unto them, The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors in the Roman system. you had benefactors who were wealthy people who took people under their wing, either adopted them formally, this was an adoption process to make them legally their children so that they could receive some kind of inheritance. And so the Lord is referring to something that was familiar among the Gentiles. And he said, "But ye shall not be so, but he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he that is chief as he that doth serve. For whether is greater, he that sitteth at meat, sitting at the supper, or he that serves? Is not he that sitteth at meat, but I am among you as he that serveth? Ye are they which have continued with me in my temptations, and I appoint unto you a kingdom, as my Father hath appointed unto me, that ye may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." This is a statement that is just so big that these men have to try to absorb this, and they don't really, I'm sure they didn't really fully understand it at this time. The full understanding may not have been made known to them until Acts chapter 2 and the Holy Spirit descending upon them. But the Lord makes a statement here in verse 31. Here's Peter sitting there at table with them. And the Lord said, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for thee, that thy faith fail not. And when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren." So here's a statement that is also cryptic and is prophetic in its nature. It's something about Peter. Now, let's stop for a minute and think about Peter. We already know about Peter in our general widespread studies about Peter that Peter was far from perfect. We know that he was a man. He was sort of a man's man, but he was a man. And and we'll talk a little bit about that in John chapter 21. But Peter here is a man who, when he hears about faith, he's been eager to follow Jesus. He's been excitable. He speaks first without thinking. He jumps to action before he realizes how far he's got to leap. All of these things are true of Peter, and he overloads himself in the commitments that he makes, and I think that bears up in what we read here. And so he means well, but he doesn't think about it before he makes his commitment. He fails when he doesn't fulfill the things he said that he would, and he disappoints himself and those that he has promised. And so maybe some of us might identify with the brashness of Peter, and I think that is the beginning of the lesson for us, that we can identify with this character that the Lord has provided us with as somebody, if it's not us, it's not ourselves, it's our brother, our father, our sister, or someone that we know that is brash, commits themselves before they've counted the cost, and then they disappoint themselves and everybody else in failure. And this happens maybe over and over and over. I'll try to be good, but they're not. I'll do this, I'll recommit myself to the Lord, but they don't. Or it lasts for a short while and they fall away. And they feel bad about it and they want to come back, and it's just a back and forth thing with them that they never seem to get a firm handle on. Well, this is my assessment of Peter. It might not be totally yours, but when Jesus says this in verse 31, Satan, he calls, and whenever you in the scriptures, it seems like when a name is repeated twice, or even the word verily, verily, you know, is truly, truly, is when it's repeated, it's for emphasis, and you're supposed to really pay attention when anything is repeated. And so Simon would doubly pay attention since his name is called twice. And the Lord says, "Behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat." We don't do much wheat sifting ourselves. I remember my mother using the old sifter thing for flour, but this is really talking about the winnowing of grain and removing the chaff from it, and then so that it would be ready to be milled and into flour or something to make bread. But the idea here is that Satan wants to use you however he wants to. That's an expression here of he wants to have complete power over you and just do you the way he wants to and get from you what he wants. He wants to get rid of the things he doesn't care for and keep the things he does. And in the eternal sense, in the sense of Peter's soul, Satan wanted to destroy Peter so that he wouldn't be useful to the Lord and to the kingdom of God. And but Jesus then says in this verse 32, this prophetic statement, he says, "But I have prayed for thee." Now this is Jesus praying for Peter. Jesus literally praying for a living human being. That's a mighty thing that's happened here. "But I have prayed for thee that thy faith fail not. And when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren." Now listen to that statement. When you are converted, isn't he converted? He's following Jesus. He's right here with him, sitting at meat with him. Jesus has turned to him and said, "I prayed for you, Peter." And yet, the statement is as if we're still waiting for you to be converted. You see, the Lord knows all things. He knew Peter's heart. He knew that Peter meant well. He knew he meant well. He knew that in the intellectual side of this and the side where this is serving Jesus is good. He is the Christ. I want to do what's right. I'm completely convinced. And yet the flesh, the spirit of the flesh, the carnos, I guess you could call it that from the Greek, isn't able to commit to the long-term, long haul that it requires to do what the Lord wants, I suppose. And but notice the statement. There's a double colon there. He says, "Thy faith fail not, and when thou art converted, comma, strengthen thy brethren." Jesus is saying a man who is not converted yet will be converted. This is going to happen. Eventually, you will be converted, and when you are, you'll strengthen your brethren. And that's interesting. But then he goes on, verse 33, "And he said unto him," Lord, Peter says to him, "Lord, I am ready to go with thee both into prison and to death." Here's Peter doing exactly what we suspect he's like. "I'm ready to die for you, and I'll go follow you right into prison. Well, if whatever happens, I'm there." And so Jesus now says prophetically again, he says, "I tell thee, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before thou, that thou shalt thrice deny that thou knowest me." So he's going to deny him three times before a rooster crows. "And he said unto them, when I sent you," and this is a reference to before, he said, "when I sent you without purse and scrip and shoes, lack ye anything?" And they said, "Nothing." We didn't lack anything. Verse 36, "Then said he unto them, but now he that hath a purse, a bag to carry money and food in, let him take it, and likewise his scrip, and he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one." It's an interesting thing. Most people in the world who haven't read the scriptures would never think that the apostles, including Peter, carried swords. But these men of peace carried swords to protect themselves, I would imagine. Maybe Judas had one. I don't know. He carried the bag. And certainly Peter, we know here, in this instance, carried a sword to defend the Lord with. And Peter has already stated, "I will die for you." And he was willing to do that by fighting to the death. And so the Lord says, "He that hath no sword, let him sell his garment, his outer coat, and buy one. For I say unto you that this that is written must yet be accomplished in me, and he that was reckoned among the transgressors, for the things concerning me have an end." Mystical kind of statement, probably referring to Judas as a transgressor and that Jesus would be hanged between two thieves and those kind of things. But nevertheless, in verse 38, it says, "And they said, Lord, behold, here are two swords." There were two of the men who owned swords. "And he said unto them, it is enough." Jesus said, "It is enough. Don't buy any more. Two's enough." And so he came out, verse 39, he came out and went as he was wanting to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples also followed him. And when he was at the place, he said unto them, "Pray that ye enter not into temptation." And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's cast, and kneeled down and prayed, saying, "Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done." We've read other accounts, I'm sure parallel accounts, that have a little more detail in them. And this was an agonizing thing, and it was a difficult thing, and it happened three times as he prayed three times. "And there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him, and being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was as it were great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And when he rose up from prayer and was come to his disciples, he found them sleeping." It says here, for sorrow. He was, you know, sorrowful that they had you know, were tired and were worn out. And he said unto them, why sleep ye? Rise and pray, lest ye enter into temptation. But they had not been listening to his prayer. Verse 47, and while he yet spake, behold, a multitude, and he that was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them, and drew near unto Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said unto him, Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss? And that is the greatest irony of all time, isn't it? That we always marvel at the fact that an act of great affection and tenderness toward one that we love was used in this way, and to such an extent that there are, like in Italian, you can say the kiss of death, and it means it comes from this, and it means that for a loved one you're willing to either buy their death or kill them yourself. It's actually incorporated into a number of cultures from this very act, and it's not really all that odd for a loved one to turn on another loved one. And so he asked this great question, verse 49, when they which were about him saw what would follow, they said unto him, Lord, shall we smite with the sword? And it, what occurs to you here at this time is those who had the swords, Peter primarily, I don't know who the other one was, but Peter primarily, what he wanted to do was, I have said that I will die for you and follow you into prison. He was willing to fight and actually die for Jesus. I don't have any doubt that that's the case here. He proves this by asking the Lord, you give me the word, Lord, and we'll smite them. You know, it was, you know, when you think about mankind, we're good at killing one another. We're good at warfare. We're good at battle. We've proven it over and over. You know, recently archaeologists and the historians that looked at the Civil War have upped the number of dead in the Civil War. Always read it was 620,000. They say it could be as many as 800,000 actually died in the Civil War. And the population of the United States was only 31 million at the time. That is an incredible figure when you think about the devastation of that war. No wonder the after effects of it were so terrible. When you fight your own brother and kill about 1 in 35 of your total number, that is just an awesomely horrible thing to think about. But we're willing to die for political causes. We're willing to die for such things. And Peter was willing to do that. This was not really extraordinary, but we would say Peter was a brave man dedicated to Jesus because he's willing to die for him. And you know, in denominationalism, you think about the history of the Catholic Church, for instance, how many hundreds of thousands, if not many millions, have died for Catholicism. I don't ever say Christianity. They died for Catholicism. And the murders that have happened, the terrible executions, the torturing of the Spanish Inquisition, and all those kind of things that happened in different countries, for the name of not Christ, but in the name of Catholicism. Other religions have done such things as well, but Jesus never, ever, ever wanted blood to be drawn to force people to try to make them believers. And this was never his plan. And so when Peter asked this question, this is really a question for all time. The Roman popes should have listened to the statement that is talked about here. If they really wanted to know the will of God, they would have read this example where the actual question was asked, shall we draw the sword to defend your being taken? Should we fight? And should we die for that cause? And it says in verse 50, and one of them smote, I mean, he didn't wait, he just whipped out the sword. It says, verse 50 here, one of them smote the servant of the high priest, who know in another account that it was a man named Malchus, cut off his right ear. And Jesus answered and said, suffer ye thus far, and touched his ear and healed him. Immediately repudiating the idea of a fight and a fight to the death. Someone was pointing out one time that a lot of the helmets that these guys wore, they wore like a Roman helmet, that the ear was exposed, and that he might have struck with his head, and the blade slipped down the side of his head and cut the man's ear off. But Jesus, in the repudiation of this terrible violence, simply touches him, it says here, and he was healed. And the miracle happened right in front of these would-be combatants. And so, verse 52 says, Jesus said unto the chief priests and captains of the temple and the elders which were come to him, be ye come out as against the thief with swords and staves? When I was daily with you in the temple, ye stretched forth no hands against me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness. Then took they him and led, and it is ironic because he was every day in the temple, but there were crowds of people there listening and realizing that that if they tried to, that there would be a riot because Jesus had done no harm. He hadn't misquoted the scriptures. He had not profaned the temple or any of those kind of things. And so their taking him would have been purely a maniacal, kind of tyrannical thing that the tyrannical types of government, like the Sanhedrin really was. That's the kind of thing they do, but these people would not have stood for it. So they take him in the dark, in the darkness of night, with men who are armed, well, heavily armed, more so than the disciples. And so they take him, verse 54, they took him and led him and brought him into the high priest's house, and Peter followed afar off. And when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the hall and were set down together, Peter sat down among them. But a certain maid beheld him as he sat by the fire, and earnestly looked upon him, and said, "This man was also with him." So this young woman, this unmarried woman, saw that Peter was she recognized him. And verse 57, immediately he denied, says he, and he denied him, saying, "Woman, I know him not." Now this is as if, "Woman, you don't know what you're talking about, so hush." And so he had stopped this line of questioning by her. And after a little while, verse 58, another saw him and said, "Thou art also of them, of the group that come out of Galilee." And Peter said, "Man, I am not." It's even more vociferous in his denial. Verse 59, and about the space of 1 hour after, another person confidently affirmed, saying, "And the truth, this fellow also was with him, for he is a Galilean." I've always thought about this, that the Galilean must have spoken with a Galilean accent, that his speech betrayed him. And so the remoteness, in fact, there was kind of an idea that the Galileans were troublemakers and hicks and that kind of thing. So, of course, this is the bench that was with Jesus, and his speech betrayed him. And so verse 60 said, and Peter said, "Man, I know not what thou sayest." And immediately while he yet spoke, the cock crew. And the Lord turned. Apparently he was in a position where Jesus could look upon him. The Lord turned and looked upon Peter, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said unto him, "Before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice." And Peter went out and wept bitterly. We know this story. And we know that it is a story of a man who had, obviously, in the telling of this and the reading of this one more time for our refreshing our memory of what it says, we put all this together, and we see here Peter in this sort of pattern that is recognizable to a lot of us. That here's one who has professed his faith. Yes, I believe in Jesus. I'll do any. And he was very active and spoke first and was sort of the leader of the men, in that he would speak first and go into places first and you noticed him first and all that kind of stuff. He was outgoing, seems like, and it was his personality to be that way. And he believed in getting things done. He liked to get stuff done. That's probably true about him. And yet, he has failed in the actual commitment to the Lord in the deeper way, in the way that he needed to be. And so the tears that are shed are recognizable tears to those of us who know this person, who know this personality, who know this failing, the fact that, once again, I've disappointed. Once again, my Lord looks down upon me with a great need to have mercy upon me because I failed him. Even though I committed, I promised, I failed him. And this is a lesson for all time for us to look at Peter. And I think that's a very apt thing for us to do when we look at this. Now let's turn over to our text of study tonight in chapter 21. We'll look at virtually the whole chapter. It's not very long anyway. But you know, there are words that, the word love is the word that's used over here later in this chapter that we'll make application from. And the Lord, I remember my dad told me about this one time. He said that, because my granddad, dad's father, never went very far in school, and he certainly never studied Greek. But the way he would determine the meaning of a word, and this is how you do it without a concordance or a Bible dictionary or the internet, you take related passages of Scripture and you read them in context to determine the meaning of the word. And when you read the every place that the word is used and the context of it, you can determine the original meaning of it. It's laborious. It's time consuming. But in the process, you learn the Bible real well. And this is the way it was done a long time ago among people who never understood any Greek. Even though we know the New Testament was written in the common tongue of that time, of the New Testament age, that was Greek. And along with the Roman roads that made travel fast and dependable, and the Pax Romana, the peace on the highways, the Romans didn't allow thievery. Any kind of robbers were immediately punished and hanged and beheaded and all that kind of stuff. And so the whole empire was very safe, and commerce could flow, and it did quickly. And the language that everyone spoke in the Roman Empire was not Latin, only among the Italians themselves. But the empire spoke Koine, or common Greek. And this is the Bible, the New Testament, conveniently enough, is completely written in this language so that it could be understood by everyone and be taken as copies that are taken on those Roman roads with the peace of Rome and those things to benefit the rapid spread of the gospel. And that's exactly what happened. The word love, and as that we study from time to time in all kinds of contexts from the New Testament, you can look, of course, we all would say that John 3:16, the word love that's used there, is the word agape. And there are longer definitions for it, but let me give you my little quick definition, and that is devotional love. That's not all of it, but the idea of devotion, devotedness to one, to the point, to the fullest extent of devotion. And we know that Jesus defines it as the love that one would die for someone else. That's the kind of devotion we're talking about. The sacrificial love. Devotion of that kind. So you might call it sacrificial love. A mother might love her child, of course, to the extent that we would expect that she might die, or a father might die for his child. But that's almost biological. Certainly we expect that parents might die for their children. That's as horrible as an idea as that is. It's expected. It's understood. But a friend who dies for another friend, or what the Lord is talking about, if you're really my friend, you'll obey my commandments. And those kind of things lead us to understand that if you really love me, if you truly love me, if you love me, you'll obey my commandments. Think about that statement. Love, if you're totally and completely devoted to me, you'll keep my commandments. That was the term that the Lord used, was agape, for such things. In John chapter 13, verse 23, there's another word that's used. And in the English, we have not done the best job of translating these two words. And that's why we study the word love from time to time, because really the word that's used there is really tender affection. We've all had friends that we think a lot of, that we feel like would do just about anything for them, and might not die for them, but we would we feel close to them, and we care about them, and we correspond with them, and we talk to them, and we like to hang out with them, and those kind of things. But it's just really tender affection, and it's a lesser kind of love, obviously, than the sacrificial devotion that the Lord uses here so strongly. And he uses it sometimes, and sometimes in the New Testament is the other word. There are other words in the Greek. Eros is not there in the New Testament, and there's one other form of love that was known in Greek, but it's not used in the New Testament. We're only having to deal with two words that we see this four letters L-O-V-E in English, as we're limited to express. So we have to sort them out when we read them, and it makes a difference. And so let's start at chapter 1 here in 21. Here Jesus has been resurrected from the dead. He was in the tomb 3 days. On the third day, he rose from the dead. And he walked among men. He appeared several times to his disciples. Not a dozen times, just a few times. And here is a case of when he did. And it says here, after these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. Now, the Sea of Tiberias is our familiar Sea of Galilee. It was called the Kinnereth in the Old Testament, but it's Galilee. And it was renamed for Emperor Tiberius. And so here it's recorded in that way. And it says, and on this wise, this is the way he showed himself. Verse 2, there were together Simon Peter and Thomas, called Didymus, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, that's James and John, and two other of his disciples. Simon Peter saith unto them, I go a-fishing. Again, I think in that little statement, I don't think we're really reading too much into it. This, notice who the one says, I'm going fishing. No, the other, they're just there, and I'm going fishing. And the other said, oh, okay, we'll go with you. It's Peter who says, you know, we've been maybe sitting around here too long. I don't know what else to do. This is a man who owns a fishing ship, and it's described in that terms because there was a ship, and then there's a smaller boat that they rowed from the ship to the shore. So the big boat is so large it can't be brought into, maybe on a pier, but not to the shore. So they used a smaller boat in this account. So he had a business. Jesus healed his mother-in-law. That means he had a wife. Usually when you get a mother-in-law, you get the wife too. And more than likely a family. And so he was a family man. But for the period of time that he followed Jesus, he didn't fish. Maybe others fished. I would imagine that somebody used his equipment, his boats and stuff, and kept them in working order for the 2 to 3 years that he followed Jesus. But he never did sell them. He kept his fishing business. And the way that fishing business was done in the ages before refrigeration and those kind of things is that you fished at night, particularly on Galilee. It was a deep lake, very, very deep, and a freshwater lake, spring-fed, and had all the says there's 153 fish down here that they catch. And some biologists have said there's how many species there are. I don't know if that's true or not, but some of the commentaries render it that way, that when they brought this catch up, there were an example of every species of fish, and that's representative of all the races and nations of man. That would be read that kind of stuff, you don't know. But nevertheless, the way they would fish is they would fish at night. Whatever they caught, they would bring to the market, and people who wanted fish that day would come early in the morning and buy the fish right off the boat, fresh from the catch that night. If they didn't catch anything, they cleaned their nets and went home. And they were cotton nets, so they had to be washed and cleaned and all the gunk taken off of them, or they would rot right away, put out to dry. So this was a life that was backbreaking because it was hard. These nets were heavy. The rowing of the boats and all that action was hard. Everything was tough, I guess, in those days. But certainly fishing was a strenuous thing. It had to be done at night. And all of those things are more than likely true about it. But so when he says this, I go a-fishing, it's as if he suddenly remembers now, Jesus is not here, a number of maybe 2 or 3 weeks has gone by, and they don't have any direction yet on what to do, if we're going to do anything, so let's go to fishing. And so they say unto him, we also go with thee. And they went forth and entered into a ship, and it's Peter's ship immediately, and that night they caught nothing. And this was not uncommon. In fact, when Peter is actually introduced, when Jesus introduces himself to Peter, it's the same situation. Jesus watches them from the shore as they're fishing, and they fished all night and caught nothing, and he tells them to throw the net on the other side, and they brought up a huge net full of fish, and this is when Jesus tells them that he wants them to be fishers of men. So they've had this experience actually before. And so they've gone the whole night, they haven't caught anything, but look at verse 4. But when the morning was now come, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples knew not that it was Jesus. The language of this in the original tongue is telling us that Jesus simply appeared on the shore. And we're not to find that incredible, because it's totally credible. Jesus is the master of creation. He's the one who made all matter. He is the one who coalesced all things in existence. He can appear wherever he wants to. He can teleport. He can do anything science fiction has ever imagined. Jesus can do it better. And so he simply appeared on the shore in front of them. And that's all it says about it, is that he did. But he also had the ability to make them not understand or not be able to tell who he was. But the disciples knew not that it was Jesus. They'd just been following him for nearly 3 years, and they didn't recognize him because he didn't want them to at this point. Verse 5, then Jesus saith unto them, children, have ye any meat? And they answered him and said, no. In the original language, children here would translate roughly to what we might say on the lake. Boys, have you caught anything? Something like that. And it's the familiarity that we want to notice, that he is familiar. His greeting to them is common. as if he is their friend, as if he is their big brother. I'm looking out for you. It's like that. That's the kind of connotation that's involved in this language. Children, have you any meat? And they answered, no. You know, you can almost hear the dejected tone, no. And he said unto them, cast the net on the right side of the ship, and ye shall find. And, well, they cast, therefore, and now they were not able to draw it in for the multitude of fishes. This had happened to them before. And the meaning of this begins to dawn on one in particular. And therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved saith unto Peter, who's this disciple whom Jesus loved? It's John. And this is what John records of himself in his writings. He didn't ever name himself. That's sort of bragging about it. But the word that is used here is the tender affection. And so this was they were buddies, they were friends, and it's a little bit incredible for us sometimes to think of Jesus having a buddy or someone who is his friend. And I don't know if you want to put it in such common terms, but they had great affection for one another, literally. And this is a good and wonderful thing. All of us have had good dear friends that you love to slap them on the back, you love to give them a hug. Sometimes you like to eat with them, you like to rest, you like to the fish together, all those kind of things. They're friends. They're people you count on. Well, that's the depth of affection that can grow in this situation. And so, therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved saith unto Peter, it is the Lord. Now, when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he girt his fisher's coat unto him, for he was naked, and did cast himself into the sea. They were not out there naked. But they did, according to Jewish custom, they would have had a cloth that they wrapped around their middle that kept them modest in the most modest way, and would have worn something like a little coat. It says a fisher's coat, which was like a long vest, and this was how they were dressed. And so he girt or brought it around him, his fisher's coat, and jumped into the sea. So he jumped into the sea. And the other disciples came in a little ship, for they were not far from land, but as it were 200 cubits. A cubit is maybe 18 inches, so we're talking about, what, 300 feet, is that right? That wasn't much. And so that wasn't very far, 100 yards. And they, in the small boat, this I guess a rowboat, they took the ends of the net with the fish in them. They held those ends in the rowboat, and some of them were rowing, and they were pulling the net to shore. They didn't have to get it that far. It's not that far. But they were laboring to do this. Now, the interesting thing that has happened here is that Peter has jumped in the water and forgot about the fish. And I read somewhere one time where someone said, well, here's a miraculous catch of fish. And Peter has said, forget that, I'm going to see Jesus. And the other said, no, we're keeping the fish. You know, it was sort of, some were practical minded. You know, this has been provided by the Lord. We're not going to let him go. But Peter was so excited in his just seeing Jesus, who has risen from the dead, and he's seen him before and knows it, but hadn't been with him constantly. He wants to see him again. He just abandons everything. And this is an example of his impulsiveness. He was impulsive. Not wrong, it's just impulsive of him to do this. But the others responsibly keep the ends of the net, and they row, dragging the net, it says, with the fishes in it. And so, as soon as they were come to land, they saw a fire of coals there, and fish laid thereon, and bread. And Jesus saith unto them, bring of the fish which ye have now caught. In this scene that we are reading and picturing for ourselves, Jesus had appeared on the shore, he's spoken to them, and they come to him, they come dragging this net of fish. When they get to shore, there is a fire going, there is food cooking, there's bread provided. Jesus has made them breakfast that morning. Now let's get the picture here. This is the night is past, morning has now come. Jesus has made food for them to share together. It's a fine thing to do with friends, people who love each other like that, to share food together and in such a setting. And so they that's what they're going to do. And Jesus provided this for them. He knew that it was something they wanted and would appreciate, and so he provided for them. And so Jesus said unto them, bring of the fish which ye have now caught. Bring those fish too. And Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land full of great fishes, 153. And for all there were so many, yet was not the net broken. Well, these were cotton nets. They didn't have any other fiber but that. And so who knows how long, they used cotton nets, and so these could break, but they didn't. This was a miracle that was involved here, and all these fish were caught in one swoop of the net, one gathering of the net. And something to note here is that all of the other disciples had gotten into the small boat and rowed, dragging the net, and yet Peter goes and grabs the end of the net and pulls it out of the water by himself. And that's why some have postulated that his name was the Rock, because he was a big, strong man. He was physically capable, and his nickname was this. Well, he was known as being a very strong individual, probably from pulling nets, I would guess. So here he is, impulsive Peter that he is. Now he goes and jumps and does what the Lord says and brings the fish in. And verse 12 says, Jesus saith unto them, Come and dine. And none of the disciples durst ask him, Who art thou? Now they know, you see, knowing that it was the Lord. Now, we're coming to the part of the application of our lesson. When verse 13 says, Jesus then cometh and taketh bread and giveth them fish likewise. So they're all going to eat. This is now the third time that Jesus showed himself to his disciples after that he was risen from the dead. Verse 15. So when they had dined, Jesus saith to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? And he saith unto him, Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, Feed my lambs. He saith to him again the second time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? He saith unto him, Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, Feed my sheep. He saith unto him the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? And Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, Lovest thou me? And he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee. Jesus saith unto him, Feed my sheep. Now, most of the time, and I was saying that understanding of the meaning of these words here was not made clear to me until I was in my mid-20s. And when you profile or look at the personality of Peter and understand what kind of a man that he was, and that he's an identifiable, there has identifiable characteristics that we recognize, whether it's in ourselves or someone that we love otherwise. We say, I know him, I know this person, and if we're truthful, sometimes we'll say, I have some of those qualities. Each of us may say we have those qualities too. And but so as he says here, let's go through these words and give them the proper identity, the proper definition. Verse 15, so when they had dined, Jesus saith to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? And the word that's used here in this verse is agape, or a form of this sacrificial, devotional love that I was talking about. Are you willing to die for me, ultimately, is the idea. And so he said, Peter says back to him, Yes, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. And he doesn't use the word agape. He uses the word for tender affection. He uses phileo. And so Peter is saying, Lord, you know me, and you know that I'm not willing to die for you, that I can't die for you because I failed you. That's sort of the idea. So he says unto him, Jesus then answers as if he had not answered the question, because it's not the same question he's asking. What Peter answers is different. It's that downgraded version of love, not the willingness to serve to the great sense of devotion. Peter knew that he had failed Jesus, and even though he had been willing to die, he had misunderstood what he was supposed to do. He had misunderstood what really was required. And so he says to the Lord, Thou knowest that I only have tender affection for you. And so Jesus says to him, Feed my lambs. With regardless of what Peter has just said in this honest answer Peter gave him, Jesus still gives him this commission, in a sense. I guess it's a commission. Feed my lambs, which means baby sheep. We know what lambs are. So in the translation is clear. It's baby sheep. So the next verse, verse 16, he said to him again, the second time, Simon, son of Jonas, and this is giving his full name. It's like, somewhat like your mom or someone in a great authority says to you, by your full name, the name I gave you, if you really want to get a child to pay attention, you call them by their whole name. And this is the way Jesus is referring to him, and hailing his father's name into the whole deal. Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? And he says unto him, Yea, Lord. And Jesus is using the word agape again, sacrificial devotion. Are you willing to die in your service to me? He says unto him, Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. And the word again is philia. And so Jesus says unto him, Feed my sheep. And the word from the Greek here means mature sheep. And so verse 17, here's the third time. He said unto him the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Now listen to Peter's response. Why is Peter, now when I was up until probably 25, like I said, 24, 25, I thought the significance here was that Jesus made him repeat his devotion to him three times because he had denied him three times. And there's certainly that element, I think, to this. But in the actual translation of the words, there's something interesting. If you don't know this, it's very interesting. Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Jesus uses philia here instead of agape in the third question. He doesn't use agape again. He uses philia. And its importance here is that Jesus shows his understanding of Peter's nature and what he had proven so far that he had to overcome, I think. It says Peter was grieved. Because he said unto him the third time, Philia, you only have tender affection for me. And when Jesus said, "Lovest thou me," he meant you only have tender affection. You don't have the level of willing to die for. Although Peter was actually, he drew the sword. But what Jesus is talking about here is the notion that you have failed in your faith, you denied me three times, there's still something lacking in you, the impetuous nature, the never counting the cost before you jump, never sticking to it, never staying with it, never finishing what you're supposed to, those kind of things are involved. And he said to him, Lord, thou knowest all things, thou knowest that I only have tender affection for you. Jesus said unto him, feed my sheep, which means the flock, all of them, feed all my sheep. Now, there in this rendering, as we look at it that way, in the actual translation from the Greek, to understand this, there's some things going on here that are good for us if we have ever ourselves felt like we failed in our service to the Lord, that the Lord will have us, even sometimes, you see, in His great mercy, beginning with just what we are. Nothing more, but just what we are. But Jesus made every single one of us with potential. I know that sounds hokey, but he made us. He designed us. He knows we're designed just like the eagle is to be able to fly from 10,000 feet and see that little mouse stick his little nose out of a knot hole somewhere, and that he can see that from so high. The same God that made the eyes on the eagle made mankind and then told us how we could be. How we could rise above the simple nature that science and our society tells us we're only animals, and you should just please yourself. If you have an itch, scratch it. If you want whatever you want to do in this world, do it. Be free. Kick off the shackles of inhibited behavior and the teachings that you perceive from religion and those kind of things. You know, our society tries to destroy us and tell us that we're only animals. And Satan is, of course, behind all of that. We need to recognize the source of that. But see here, Jesus knows this man, and he loves this man, and he has provided for his salvation if only Peter will accept it. Now, Jesus knows that he will. He knows that Peter will. He looks ahead. He knows all things. And so Jesus now prophetically tells Peter how he is going to end up. And he says, truly, truly, or verily, verily, here in verse 18, I say unto thee, when thou wast young, thou girdest thyself and walkest whither thou wouldest. But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands, and another shall gird thee and carry thee whither thou wouldest not. This spake he, signifying by what death he should glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said unto him, follow me. Now, essentially, our lesson here is complete. We've looked at the scriptures that are necessary. And Jesus telling Peter this, you know, Peter, of course, Jesus has come down in the terms from do you have now, at this moment, do you have sacrificial love for me? Jesus has come now into the third statement of saying, I know that you only have tender affection for me, but let me tell you how this is going to turn out. You're going to turn out dying for me. You will show that you did have sacrificial love for me in the final analysis. When your life is finally the completion after your years of service to me, you will die for my, in my service. And he actually tells here that he says, when you think about this, it's sort of a almost poetic the way he says this, that when you're a young person, you go about and you wrap your belt around you and you go where you want to and you free and easy life that you do whatever you want to without responsibility. But when you're old, he says, and your life is old, is what he's referring to, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands, and another shall bind you and carry you whither thou wouldest not. This, and it tells us clearly, signifying by what death he should glorify God. Now, in the historical context, Peter was always is depicted as being crucified upside down, and the old story about this, whether we don't know whether it's true or not, was that when they wanted to crucify Peter, he said, "Do not crucify me in the same. Do not kill me in the same manner that you killed my Lord." And so they did it upside down. Now that's the story. But this is very close to something like that. So all we know is what really is said here. But Jesus is saying that at the end of your life of service, you will actually prove that you had devotional, sacrificial love for me. I think that's an incredible thing that Jesus is saying. Now, in the application to us for this, and I've sort of been making application all through it, but realize that in your life as a child of God, maybe from the very outset, maybe from some of us, I obeyed the gospel when I was 11 years old. Some of you maybe at that age, or even some younger, but some later, whatever it was for you, maybe you got up, started off great. I remember when I was baptized the next day I went to school. I was baptized on a Sunday, went to school the next day, and told people I was all excited that nobody cared. And that's about the way it is, right? Who cares? So what? Everybody gets baptized. So what? Big deal. You know, and so it goes, you know, your all of your excitement just, you know, and your zeal goes with it. And so you realize pretty quick it's going to be a day after day slog. Man, nobody's happy about this. When you tell people about the Lord's church, when you tell them about the plan of salvation, when you say something's wrong, you know, why don't you do this? You know, you're constantly beset by discouragement. And over time, that works on every single one of us. We're outnumbered in this world. We always will be. But you're to take strength from the fact that the Lord knows all of that. He knows all of that. And your life is a living sacrifice of devotion that He expects for you to spend in His service. We have to get stronger. We have to gain confidence. Look like as the apostles did, with all boldness, they declared the gospel to those that they could preach and teach to without having any actual formal skills whatsoever. Uneducated men preach the gospel to the most highly educated people in the land, the most powerful people in the land, with courage because of their faith, the courage that faith supplied them. They did what they had to bring the gospel to the world. We're no less, and actually we understand we're no more. But we can do the same work that these men in the New Testament did, and we have the full gospel of Jesus Christ that has been provided for us in our time. We can easily hold it in our hand. We can understand it. We can read it. We can be fortified from it, and we can face each and every day. Now, if you feel like in your life that you have disappointed the Lord over and over and over, remember that the Lord knows you, and He has made a plan that will bring you back to Him. You can be completely restored. You can be completely forgiven of the things that you've done. You don't have to continue always disappointing the Lord. You can become a servant of the Lord in the same way that Peter was. And I don't mean that we have to be crucified upside down. I don't mean that. I mean that in our life, we do everything that we can. We live in a wonderful country. We have religious freedom still, and we can do as we need to. And so there's no bindings upon us to keep us back. We need to understand that the Lord understands our disappointments and our failures, and we should not say, give ourselves an excuse to say, "Oh well, I've tried it before and I'm no good at it." That's not the way it works, because the Lord has tremendous amounts of mercy, and we can be forgiven of our sins. we can be restored once again because of the great mercy of our Lord. Our prayers need to be rich with the concept of, Lord, have mercy upon me. Show me the way. Like the apostles did, they said, Lord, increase my faith. And we can do what Peter did. We can do what we must in this life. You can grow. You can be a strong Christian. You can do everything that you need to, because the Lord has provided the information that we can be fully utilized. And even in the ways that we disappointed others, maybe our parents, maybe others in our lives that have looked up to us as an example, we can turn that around. It's not ever too late for any of us. Tonight, if you're a child of God and you have fallen away from the Lord, you have an opportunity to make things right with Him, and I pray that you do tonight. There might be someone in our audience who's not a Christian. You thought about your soul's condition. You certainly believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and you're willing to make that statement from here. Turning away from your sins, calling upon Him, you can be baptized for remission of sin tonight and begin that life like you know you should, as together we stand and sing. Jesus,